Discourse on Habeas Corpus by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 5, Habeas Corpus Application, Law, and Effective Legislation, continued. The next case is a habeas corpus case, and is in the previous cases, I will read portions, and then I will repeat the significant or extremely relevant portions. In 1858, the United States Supreme Court ruled on a case styled Abelman versus Booth, A-B-L-E-M-A-N versus Booth, at 62 U.S. 506. Justice Taney gave the decision of the court. Booth was charged with harboring a fugitive slave. He was arrested by a commissioner, that was the title of the person, Abelman, for harboring that slave. Booth then went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court demanding a writ of habeas corpus, which was granted, and he was released. Well, Abelman, working for the federal government, got the U.S. government to take this to the United States Supreme Court and challenged the grant of habeas corpus and the releasing of Booth by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Now, from that decision, the same purposes are clearly indicated by the different language employed when conferring supremacy upon the laws of the United States and the jurisdiction upon its courts. In the first case, it provides that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land and obligatory upon the judges in every state. The sovereignty to be created was to be limited in its power of legislation, and if it passed a law not authorized by its enumerated powers, it was not to be regarded as the supreme law of the land, nor were the state judges bound to carry it into execution. So he's saying the sovereignty created was to be limited in its powers of legislation, and if it passed a law not authorized by its enumerated powers, it was not to be regarded as the supreme law of the land, nor were the state judges bound to carry it into execution. So this is where there was odds between the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because Wisconsin Supreme Court didn't recognize that a freed slave had to be returned to his master. He continues, the judicial power was justly regarded as indispensable not merely to maintain the supremacy of the laws of the United States, but also to guard the states from any encroachment upon their reserved rights by the general government. If it appears that an act of Congress is not pursuant to and within the limits of the power assigned to the federal government, it is the duty of the courts of the United States to declare it unconstitutional and void. But also to guard the states from any encroachment upon their reserved rights by the general government, if it appears that an act of Congress is not pursuant to and within the limits of the power assigned to the federal government. It is the duty of the courts of the United States to declare it unconstitutional and void. Now, the law that was passed pursuant to the Constitution or not pursuant to the Constitution was called the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. So Wisconsin says the Fugitive Slave Act was not constitutional. You had no authority to pass it. Well, let's see if they did or not. Article 4, Section 2, Clauses 2 and 3 of the Constitution. It's Article 4, Section 2, Clauses 2 and 3. One says, a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. Now, obviously, in the South, it would be illegal. It would be a crime for a slave to break his bonds and run. So that says he has to be returned. Now, the next section says no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another state, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, in the second state, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such services or labor may be due. So that section says that somebody that's either indentured for service or labor, or held for service or labor, has to be returned back to the state that he fled from. Now, this is in the original Constitution, and so there's an authority over fleeing criminals fleeing, and there's an authority over slaves fleeing. So the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was deemed constitutional because there was what I refer to as a constitutional nexus between the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 and those two provisions of the Constitution. Whether we like them or not, they were in the Constitution, and they're binding. And so the authority was given, therefore the habeas corpus was remanded, and Booth ended up in federal prison as a consequence of his violation of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. The next case we're going to talk about is again from Wisconsin. It was 1871, 13 years later. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court supported it in another challenge of federal jurisdiction. So yeah, you got to give respect to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In this case, a guy named Edward Tarble, who was under 18 years of age, enlisted as a soldier under the name of Frank Brown. Later, Tarble deserted and was retaken and confined as a deserter. Tarble's father petitioned the court commissioners of Dane County, Wisconsin, for a writ of habeas corpus. The writ was issued, and Tarble was brought before the court. The court, quote, held that the prisoner was illegally imprisoned and detained and ordered that he be discharged from custody, end quote. So Wisconsin said, hey, you know, this guy's under 18. You have no authority to detain him. Now, this then, the federal government, the officer in charge of Tarble, actually brought this before the United States Supreme Court. It was in 1871. The case is In Re Tarble, T-A-R-B-L-E, and it's at 80 U.S. 397. That's 80 U.S. 397. Now, there were a number of things said in this case that are rather interesting and give us insight again into what I refer as the constitutional nexus, the requirement to show authority for the enactment of any law that will act on somebody as imposed by the federal government. And so in the decision, and there are within the territorial limits of each state two governments, restricted in their spheres of action, but independent of each other and supreme within their respective spheres. Each has its separate departments, each has its distinct laws, and each has its own tribunals for their enforcement. Neither government can intrude within the jurisdiction or authorize any interference therein by its judicial officers with the action of the other. The two governments in each state stand in their respective spheres of action in the same independent relation to each other, except in one particular, that they would, if their authority embraced distinct territories. The Constitution and the laws passed in pursuance of it are declared by the Constitution itself to be the supreme law of the land, and the judges of every state are bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Whenever, therefore, any conflict arises between the enactments of the two sovereignties or in the enforcement of their asserted authority, those of the national government must have supremacy until the validity of the different enactments and authorities can be finally determined by the tribunals of the United States. This temporary supremacy until judicial decision by the national tribunals and the ultimate determination of the conflict by such decision are essential to the preservation of order and peace and to the avoidance of forcible collision between the two governments. So what he said there is there are within the territorial limits of each state two governments restricted in their spheres of action but independent of each other and supreme within their respective orders. Neither government can intrude within the jurisdiction or authorize any interference therein by its judicial officers with the action of the other. He continues, state judges and state courts authorized by laws of their states to issue writs of habeas corpus have undoubtedly the right to issue the writ in any case where a party is alleged to be illegally confined within their limits, unless it appears upon his application that he is confined under the authority or claim and color of the authority of the United States by an officer of that government. And the process or orders under which the prisoner is held should be produced with the return and submitted to inspection, in order that the court or judge issuing the writ may see that the prisoner is held by the officer in good faith under the authority or claim and color of authority of the United States, and not under the mere pretense of having such authority. So he says rely on good faith, but he also points out that it can be under the pretense of having such authority, which is we refer to as color of law. Further on, he says, I cannot concur in the opinion just this was dissenting opinion. I cannot concur in the opinion just read. I have no doubt of the right of a state court to inquire into the jurisdiction of the federal court upon habeas corpus and to discharge when satisfied that the petitioner for the writ is restrained of liberty by the sentence of the court without jurisdiction. If it errs in deciding the question of jurisdiction, the error must be corrected in the mode prescribed in the 25th section of the Judiciary Act. Now, this is interesting because the first one said that good faith was necessary, even though he also said that there is a possibility of pretense of having such authority. So the dissenting opinion by Salmon Chase was to say that the state courts do have a right. And I think Rawl said that when I read the historical, the legal scholar stuff, that the state has an obligation. So there was a little dispute here, and one wasn't clear, and the other one was made quite clear by Chase. Now the question arises then, so Tarbell enlisted in the army, he lied about his age, he lied about his name, he went in the army, he deserted, he was picked up on desertion and imprisoned. Is there a constitutional nexus there? Under state law, there might be a question whether he was of age to sign the contract of enlistment if he was under 18. I'm not sure if that was in the case. It wasn't discussed as what the particulars were on the Wisconsin decision. But let's look for a constitutional nexus. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12 gives Congress the power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for longer term than 2 years. So Congress has the authority to raise and support armies. Now, that authority then has got to presume a degree of authority over the armies themselves to the extent that the legislative branch is authorized. But further, in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States. So the Commander-in-Chief is the President, and he's got authority over the Army and the Navy of the United States. So once Tarbell enlisted, even though he was under 18 and went in as Frank Brown, he did contract with the federal government to become a soldier in the Army of the federal government. He violated the rules promulgated by the Congress by desertion. He was imprisoned under desertion. And so the Supreme Court held that he could not be released under Wisconsin's grant of habeas corpus. Tarbell remained in prison. Now, the nexus was there. There are two authorities in the Constitution that establish a relationship between the legislative and the executive branches of government with anybody in the military. And to dispute that and say, well, the state can say you can't be in the military, then let's call it the Continental Army or the Union Army for sake of understanding. We have state militias, but we also have the federal army. And he joined the federal army, not the militia. Now, they could apply that at the militia because that's their sphere of jurisdiction. That's their authority. But when it comes to the Union Army, the federal army, that jurisdiction, once he enlists there, resides with the federal government. So we have a constitutional nexus. Now, both these habeas corpuses by Wisconsin were turned down. The person remained imprisoned and subject to federal jurisdiction, and both had a constitutional nexus.